Jaspreet Boparai and Don Nicholson with Greenwashed on RCR, Reality Check Radio.
You're back with RCR, Greenwashed with Don and Jaspreet, and today we're heading stateside where we meet up with a earth science professor in exile. He was formerly an assistant professor at the Department of Geological Sciences at the University of Alabama and a postdoctoral research scientist in the Department of Earth, Planetary and Space Sciences and the Institute for Planets and Exoplanets at the University of California, Los Angeles. I speak of Dr. Matthew M. Wailiki. Welcome, Dr. Wailiki. We're grateful you could come on our show.
Thanks for having me.
You have a massive backstory. Born in Poland and immigrated to United States about 1980, I gather.
Or in the 80s. Right around 1982. Yeah. So before the fall of the Iron Curtain. So, it was the People's Republic of Poland at that time.
Yeah, and boy, Poland went through a fair bit not many years before, and it's got a long history. What was the driving force for your parents to take you to America?
You know, both my parents were academics. My father has finished his PhD in computer science. My mother had a master's in computer science, and it became clear to them that the regime that was in power was not very friendly to kind of the exchange of ideas. And they were fortunate enough to have to travel a little bit, and they got to see a lot of the Western Europe and how the West was living. And they realized that they were being left behind, and they didn't really want to stay. But it was clear that if you kind of spoke out or wanted to kind of expose more people to some of these Western ideas, that was going to be essentially taboo, and the government was going to come after you. I think my father really feared that he was going to be arrested at some point. And he got a visiting professorship here in Illinois. Like all good Polish people, we go to Chicago. That's our Ellis Island. And he got a visiting professorship at Southern Illinois University. And he invited us out to visit. It didn't tell my mother that we weren't going back. And so we arrived with our suitcases for a two-week vacation. And he said, we can't go back because I think they're going to arrest us if we go back. And then we thankfully got political asylum and became citizens after that. And, the rest is history.
Well, and, just taking that on a little further, you would argue then that the United States has been a freedom place for you to live. And it's given you a lot of opportunity. Is that fair to say? And I should say to listeners, the reason I got onto and Jaspreet got onto Dr. Wailiki is we read his Substack called Irrational Fear at substack.com. And that's what got us onto you, Dr. Wailiki. And it's a stunning, you present your case simply. And I've now diverted the story. Go back to where we were.
We came for freedom. My parents left everything. They left. They didn't see their grandparents, their parents for almost a decade, right? It was 1989 when Fawenza was elected and the ship workers movement and solidarity really kind of overthrew the People's Republic of Poland and it became a democratic country. And so, that they gave up everything to give us that opportunity. But I also think that's partially why my radar maybe is a little sensitive to kind of the stories that they used to tell me. And even though I was very young, so I didn't really experience it. I really was kind of ingrained into me that this kind of socialist idea or the socialist experiment failed dramatically. And my parents had to suffer under it for decades. And so I think my radar maybe is a little sensitive to some of the things that I'm picking up on now, where I'm going, well, maybe this isn't the best idea, surrounding, things that we'll get into, like climate change.
Yeah. And that, I'm listening to you, Dr. Matthew, and that sounds so familiar, even though I didn't come from that sort of a background. But when I immigrated to New Zealand 15 years ago, it was for the ability to be able to do what we wanted, which for my husband and me in that era was a large-scale farming. And we moved to a country where there were no subsidies in New Zealand in farming. And it's supposedly research was world-class. The bureaucracy was nimble, agile, very honest. And I look back 15 years later and I go, Right. Where are we now? Is everything that honest? Is science as uncompromised? Is research actually? Because Punjab, where I come from, they had a PAU, a Punjab Agriculture University, that was supposed to be doing nothing, absolutely nothing. I had not done anything in decades for farming. And here I was trying. And I look back and I think, now, yeah, I sort of, what did I have blinkers on? But these countries, and I'm looking at Don and he's nodding, perhaps things have changed. Perhaps the dial has shifted, especially over the last few, over the COVID era, as I call it.
I think it has. I mean, I think one of the biggest shifts is that there's this push to silence any discussion or any sort of debate about certain topics. And these topics tend to be very important and ingrained into almost every policy decision that's being made, but you can't discuss it. You can't talk about it. You can't challenge it, right? And so, and I think that's really ramped up in the last few years, this kind of suppression of anybody that wants to just have some questions and maybe share some other data that people have overlooked. And it didn't used to be like that. It used to be, we used to have healthy debates, and something has definitely shifted. And I always tell people, be always the most wary of the people that are really trying to control the information, because they are the bad people. It's the control of information. It's also insulting to you, because what they're saying is that you shouldn't even be told all of the information, because you're too dumb. You may be able to make a bad decision if you're shared all the information. So the government has to curate the information for you. That to me is a very dangerous and slippery slope.
Yeah.
It's interesting, Dr. Wailiki. I have trusted people all my life. I really did trust people all around me. Never believed I was going to be shafted by the regulator or the political masters, you know, because it generally seemed to be ebbing and flowing a little bit, but generally life was okay until about the turn of the century, and environmentalism became all encompassing. But what I've learned, and I watched part of the debate between the aspiring president the vice president and the former president the other day, and what I've learned is, and it happened here too, we had a almost, well, I would call her a despotic prime minister for 6 years, very similar to Kamala Harris, actually, in the way they speak. And what I've learned is, if you take what they speak and say they really mean the opposite, you'd be more accurate, because everything they say, they actually do believe the opposite. So that's part of the nudging that we're having put through our machinery here, is listen to them at your peril, because they actually don't mean what they say. And I think that's what I observe in America now, in the States.
Yeah, it's very true. I mean, I think a lot of this stuff is just, it's lip service, because I wrote something and I showed that actually, if you look under the Biden administration, we've produced more fossil fuels than we ever did under Trump. In fact, you know, we're going gangbusters in natural gas production right now in the US. But even though Biden's up there, right, he has to pay that lip service to his base. But thankfully, they're not really pushing some of the policies that they talk about. I think they just kind of say them to appease their base. But yeah, I mean, it's interesting that both parties in the U.S. now are seeming to get kind of on board with some of these climate change policies. It seems like we talked about it a little bit before we started recording, but, you know, once the government gets a little bit of taste of some money, it's very hard for either party to even give it up. And so I'm really worried that once any of this stuff gets in and they're going to get a taste of the money, neither party is going to want to roll any of this stuff back. And we're just going to be stuck with these kind of idiotic policies.
Well, I think exhibit number one for idiotic policies would have to be in California. And I listened to Gavin Newsom, Governor Newsom, and I can't accept that anyone could vote for the guy. I mean, I'm being a bit outlandish here. The guy is so slippery and devious. You just can't trust what comes out of his mouth. I mean, California should be the best place in the world to live. It's got everything going for it. But the push for EVs, the push for electrification of everything, very similar to here actually, is built on a bit of quicksand, but he still keeps pushing it. Still keeps
pushing. Have you seen that smile and that hair?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Slick as they come.
So I grew up in California. I grew up in Fresno and did all my schooling in Southern California. And it was just, it was impossible to raise a family there. I mean, it was just, the prices were just outrageous. I mean, to, and then you'd be stuck in traffic because you have to commute, you know? And so I don't really look back with much fondness on, you know, on my time in California and trying to actually survive there. I'm kind of glad I got out.
Okay. Well, I listen to, you talk of Fresno, I listen to Victor Davis Hanson a lot. And I've been to Fresno. I've been to Clovis, one of the suburbs of Fresno. Yeah, lovely place. But if you haven't got water, it's a problem in that zone. But it is a very productive area if you can find the water. Hey, we need to get back on track here. One of the reasons you started talking about sort of the policies of the country, and once you start talking about a particular line, it's sort of like it builds on itself and the politicians just keep feeding it. Now, you call yourself an earth science professor in exile. Why did you call yourself that in your CV here?
Well, so in my time in Alabama, you know, as an assistant professor, so you have to go up for tenure. You're essentially on a probationary period for about 6 or 7 years, depending. Because it was COVID, we got an extra year. Everything kind of stopped. And so, but as I was kind of progressing through my time, I got there in 2017. And so I had just had children. I started thinking about things a little differently. I was kind of getting worried about some of the mental health impacts that maybe this constant drumbeat of like the planet's on fire was having. That wasn't really something I thought about before I became a father. And I started to talk to my students a lot about it. And when COVID hit, you know, we started having more discussions about mental health and things. And it became very clear to me that besides COVID at the time, the biggest anxiety that I saw in my students was from climate change. This is kind of the first generation that they've been just kind of instilled with this stuff ever since they were little toddlers. Ever since, you know, I was reading like the books to my three-year-old, right? We were just starting to sit down and start read to them and things like that. And there was climate change infused into these books for three-year-olds. And I was just shocked. And so I started going, okay, I'm an earth science professor. I've kind of avoided the whole climate debate because it's political and it's gross. And if you talk to most earth scientists, they don't want to touch it. We would rather go study volcanoes. And I studied asteroid impacts and things like that. I didn't really want to get involved, but I said, okay, you know, if we're really driving up anxiety in these young people, and the evidence must be overwhelming. Right. So I let me go look at this evidence. And clearly it must be overwhelming. And so as I started to dig in a little bit, I really started to, and you know, as an earth scientist, I kind of look at things maybe a little more holistically. I like to think of things on the time scales of millions, even hundreds of millions of years, or even billions of years. Part of my dissertation was on the early Earth. So I was looking at rocks that were like 4.3 billion years old. And so I noticed that there's this real focus on kind of the modern era and the satellite era. But if you kind of take a step back and you look at things in a little bit bigger picture, most of what we're seeing isn't all that irregular. And there isn't clear and evidence to me that there was a crisis or an emergency. And so I started quizzing my students and I asked them, do you think that you're in more danger from the climate than your parents were or your parents' generation? And how confident are you in your answer? And overwhelmingly, they said they're in more danger, and they were very confident in their answer. But in fact, that's exactly the opposite. This generation today is safer than any generation before from weather-related events. That's because we have great infrastructure, and we have warning systems, and we have satellites. And it has a lot to do with all this infrastructure, but also has to do with the fact that severe weather isn't just increasing, right? We have a lot more people on the planet. Everybody has a phone in their pocket, so we see videos of this more. We can document these events more than we used to be able to. So I understand that people may have this feeling, but if you start to look at the observable data, there was just no data that these kids should be really anxious about. I mean, I had young female students crying in my office telling me they were never going to have kids because they would feel too guilty to bring a child into the world because the planet was going to end in 10 or 12 years. And so I started speaking out against this. I started giving lectures about climate that were very different than what the other faculty were teaching. And the students were very refreshed. And so then I went on TikTok. Because I asked him, I said, well, you know, what social media are you guys on right now? Nobody's on Facebook, right? None of the young generations. They said they're all on TikTok. So I started making videos on TikTok during COVID, and I garnered a whole lot of response there. And I noticed very quickly that this was a subject that you cannot push against, because the university, my chair of the department, the president of the university, was getting flooded by emails and calls that, you know, this heretic, this climate denier, he's teaching these young impressionable minds and he's lying to them, even though I'm showing him just observable, you know, I'm showing him the observable data, all peer reviewed, but I'm just not skewing it in a way that these, you know, a lot of these institutions do. And so as I noticed that there was this huge backlash, I noticed that there wasn't a lot of support from my faculty. It's just too much. As a young assistant professor, you just landed this job, you've finished grad school and postdoc, you've made no money your entire life, you're actually getting a paycheck. You know, most people just want to put their head down and not rock the boat. And I just couldn't keep my mouth shut. And I started being more and more vocal, and it became very clear to me that there's no chance with the views that I'm having and the way that I'm teaching these lectures that I would ever get tenure. It just wasn't going to happen. And so that when that became clear to me, I sat down with my chair and we talked about everything. And so we decided to make the move to Colorado from Alabama. But it became clear that someone with my views, someone that was pushing back against the climate narrative, just wasn't welcome in academia at that time. There was just was no place for someone like me to get tenure and stay as a professor. So then I consider myself a professor in MSO.
And you had the backbone to do this. You know, there's so many who just go along because one thing I do note, Matthew, between you and some other guests we've had, you are among the youngest who is speaking out. We've had people speak out, but they're at, you know, towards the very end of their careers when it's all right. They've done their dash and now they feel safe because there's no longer the mortgage, the paycheck and all of this hanging. Whereas you have done this, and I know you've got children about the same age as mine, under 10. This is how has your family taken this? How have they dealt with all of this? Your parents, you know, who were both academics. What do they feel?
Yeah. So you know, it's sometimes I feel courageous, sometimes I feel crazy. I don't know. I'm walking a fine line. You know, everybody's been very supportive. So if I didn't have the support of like my family and my wife, there was no way that we would have done this. I probably would have just put my head down and maybe you would hear from me after I got tenure and I could say things a little bit more. But I didn't want to be in that institution. It just wasn't the same that my father was when he was teaching, right? It's supposed to be a place where we battle ideas and then we go have dinner and drinks afterwards, right? And this, it became that if you have these views, it's not that we just disagree and it's like we disagree on one little aspect and we agree on 99 other, but you're immoral now. If you have this view,
yes,
you're like immoral. You're a bad person. We have to kick you out of the tribe. And that just wasn't a place that I wanted to be in anymore. It wasn't that free exchange of ideas that my father instilled in me. And I grew up on a college campus at Fresno State. That's where he was a professor. And, you know, that's what I saw. I saw these guys battling it out and, you know, male, female, everybody was battling it out with ideas. And then they would shake hands and go have a drink afterwards and realize that they're all kind of looking to try to solve a problem. We all want the best for everybody. We just have different ways of going about it. And we disagree about certain topics. But now it's this person is immoral. They're a bad person. They're evil.
Yeah,
you know,
they like everyone in little boxes. Like I often say, farmers, we've just been painted by media as environmental vandals, and that's a sticky tag. And that's what we've been pretty much confined with. If you're doing farming, I know people who would not want to have that out publicly. That oh no, just doing a bit there and a stint here. And over the 15 years we've been here, my husband and I, we noted the younger people coming in New Zealand in farming became fewer and fewer. We used to have backpackers who would come through, work on the farms, and we've worked on large-scale farms here. And over the 15 years of, you know, the busy period, the spring when we would hire someone, we started seeing adverts on the same backpacker boards where we would get these staffers from, looking for a vegan, permaculture, regenerative place. And Yeah. And we were like, well, whatever happened? We used to have a whole lot of German and Belgian backpackers who would come through, and these guys and girls would hop on a tractor, no problem, take care of the gear. And you wonder what sort of indoctrination is going on. And yet, when I look at universities, I'm looking here as I speak to you at our couple of our universities. So Auckland University's Earth Science Department webpage, the Massey University, the Victoria University of Wellington, and the paper says, Earth Sciences, we'll explore the evolution of the Earth from its molten beginnings to the dynamic planet we live on today. Similar things are echoed. It's a dynamic planet. So it has always changed. And yet this very line from which all of these courses seem to begin then suddenly morph into, we need to stop everything changing.
It's remarkable. They call us deniers, climate deniers, and they want stasis. I'm like, I'm the only one that's claiming that there's no stasis. Like the idea you're going to control Mother Nature and keep it in this nice little pretty place because we built cities 2000 years ago, because that means anything to how the planet operates, is just absurd.
Yeah.
It's a crazy world. Now, going back to your university, and Jaspreet and I started the show 18 months ago, and Jaspreet was hot on environmental social governance rules, or the United Nations SDGs, but then ESGs and DEI. And clearly the DEI policies, diversity, equity, inclusion policies of the universities, not just the Alabama one, is having a huge impact on the whole institutions of learning. Is that something you want to make comment about, how illiberal the DEI policies have become and how all constraining they are?
Yeah, so I really, I knocked the ball out of the park, because I picked the two topics to stick my neck out that you can't talk about: climate change and DEI. And I made the arguments because I was talking to a lot of the students and I was noticing that, there was something called unlearning racism in geoscience, URGE. Oh. This was a huge NSF project and a grant, and there were all these little pods that the graduate students would make. And I noticed that one of these popped up in our department, and our department was about 50-50 female and male. Actually, we had a little bit more females. It was like 55 to 45 female to male. And we had a very diverse group. We had quite a few students from India and China. We had quite a few students from Africa. And what I noticed was that the seven group, the pod, became white students with one minority student. So I started talking to other minority students and said, why aren't you guys joining this pod? And it became very clear to me. They said, look, we don't need these saviors. Like, why are you guys out here trying to pretend like we didn't earn our way here? Like, this is ridiculous. You guys, it's like, we don't need you guys to try to save us. And so it really became clear to me. I said, wow, this is having the exact opposite effect that it's supposed to do, right? The idea for the DEI department, if you went to the DEI webpage on University of Alabama, which no longer exists because they shut the entire DEI department down for the whole University of Alabama system, you're welcome, Alabama. But when I started showing people that this is not having the expected results, in fact, it's having the opposite. Students are isolating themselves. They don't want to collaborate. They don't even want to possibly say the wrong thing, because if it gets taken out of context, they could be labeled something. And there's this big push to tell on each other. And so it was doing the exact opposite. And the university was spending enormous amounts of money on this huge bureaucracy on DEI, which was having the exact opposite outcomes. And I started speaking up against that. And obviously, as a white male, that's very taboo to say. And so now I was a climate denier and a racist. And so then it became doubly clear to me that I had no place in academia. But it was remarkable. It was all consuming for a little while there after 2020 and the George Floyd riots and things like that. Almost every decision that the university, including us as a department, were making was framed in the lens of DEI, who we hired, what students were coming. Everything was framed through a lens of DEI. And so it was all consuming for a while. And now they shut those departments down, but they just shifted those administrative positions around. They're still there. Those people are still consuming huge amounts of money, and they produce nothing. They don't teach any students. They don't produce grants. They don't write papers, right? This is just this administrative bloat that has taken over in the universities just so they could virtue signal that they're all inclusive and that they, that they're a diverse community.
And you made the point that they don't produce anything. I have this view that there's plenty of people in the world that don't produce anything useful, and yet they have the gall to tell me that as a farmer, I am an environmental vandal, and that we shouldn't be using the environment. I have a view that the environment gives up everything for us all, every moment of every day. There is nothing that we do without the use or harvest of the environment. But we have these people making these little edicts and control edicts that are saying what we should and shouldn't do. I find it quite arrogant, Dr. Wailiki, and it's great that you have stood up to it. What do you see as a trend away from it? I'm reading media now that, for instance, going to the ESG component for a moment, that ESG reporting is turning into a massive nightmare for companies. Stakeholder capitalism is abhorrent. We've got to get back to shareholder ownership and strength. Do you sense that there's a winding back? Because in New Zealand, I'll just give one example. We have our national airline has failed to meet its 2030 targets, has given up on them actually for emission profiling, even though they've bought the rights to emit from so much forestry planting, they've given up. So, and now I've read articles where it's costing small companies up to $1 million. When I say small, they're not 100 million company type companies, $1 million a year to comply with ESG reporting. People aren't wanting to see their value lost through this sort of stuff. Are you sensing there's a change on? Because, and will it take a Donald Trump versus a Kamala Harris to get this to move, or is it beyond them even?
Yeah, I do think it's beyond them, but I think there is a backlash, right? I think everything kind of ebbs and flows, and it was clearly went way too far. So you've seen pullback in academia for the DEI departments. Like I said, unfortunately, they're just kind of shuffling people around. But I think when I started speaking out about this, I was shocked by the number of emails I got from people in the corporate world that were talking to me about ESG, saying, "You think you've got it bad in academia? Look at all this stuff that we're doing. Look at all this money that we're wasting." And it's becoming clear that when someone goes and purchases a product, they don't really think about, am I going to purchase this? And what were their targets? Did this company hit their target? Nobody thinks like that as a consumer, right? This is just wasted money for virtue signaling. But I do think it's rolling back.
And in this inflationary environment, they keep telling us that, markets overseas are demanding low methane beef and low methane milk. And it's like, right. We have one globalist outfit, someone like Nestle, holding us to ransom here, and suddenly everyone signs all these sort of accords. And I think as people, we do need to take responsibility that we've been guilty of just letting the stuff slide. It's, it's just one more treaty or just one more. Doesn't matter anything. The UN paperwork doesn't matter anything. Oh, it's all voluntary. And as we've realized, to our own peril, it is not. But perhaps at this point, it's time to head to the climate narrative here, Dr. Wailiki. CO2 is, we talk about a dynamic planet, and we have decided that there's one knob. You turn that on, you turn that off, carbon dioxide, and we can magically just transform everything and have, what are the words, John, that they use? A sustainable, resilient planet?
Yeah, it's remarkable because, the thing that got me interested in earth science, my original background is biochemistry, but I loved the complexity of the Earth system, right? It's just such a beautiful system. There's so many things at play, the atmosphere, the hydrosphere, the biosphere, space weather, right? And it's so resilient, right? We look back and as a geologist, you start to look at the planet and you go, holy moly, like there's been giant meteor impacts and super volcanoes and, just massive tsunamis. And this planet isn't some little fragile orb floating in space, right? It's a very resilient system, and it's designed and built such that all these interacting parts kind of play together. And the idea that you can tweak one variable, and it's an uncoupled system, meaning that when you tweak one variable, you don't really know how the other variable is going to behave. And we know that's true because we've seen really warm periods with low CO2, and we've had glacial periods when CO2 was in the 1400 or so PPM, close to four times what it is today. So right? It's just, it's a reductionist view of a really beautiful and complex system, but it's done for a reason, right? Because if you took all the complexity and the nuance, it would be very difficult to apply taxes and control. But if you reduce it to a single trace gas in the atmosphere, right, that's in the order of parts per million, then it's a way that you can start to control it, right? And so it's unfortunate, because what got me interested is that the beauty of the complexity of the system, and they reduce it to a single trace gas and then sell this whole narrative behind the single trace gas. It's unfortunate.
Yeah, and of course, it's a convenient, unfortunate behavior that's hit the narrative, you know, the mainstream narrative. What is amusing to me as a person that's, or unamusing to me actually, for a person that's followed this for almost 45 or 50 years, from the slow discussion about carbon trading when I was a farm forester to where we are today, I can't understand why society has only really ramped up its concern in perhaps the last 4 or 5 years. Just pre-COVID and during COVID, all of a sudden climate has become bigger than Texas, as we say here. It doesn't seem right when this has been around, this discussion, for those of us that were observing for close to 50 years. And in fact, it goes back further that I've since found. But why is it that it's become almost fever pitched now? Or that's how I observe it.
Well, I think they're taking a play out of the COVID playbook, right? That they realized how, if you sold COVID as this immense threat, and right on the horizon, you could do dramatic things. You could radically change how the laws were being, you know, in the US particularly, but also, you know, for you guys. And so I think that was a play out of the COVID playbook. And they're realizing that, okay, if we ratchet up the rhetoric, and you can see this in the IPCC, has hired social scientists to talk to them about how they can use certain language to elicit an emotional response. Right. And so if you can elicit that emotional response, if you could freak people out, and I argue irrationally, then you can really start to implement things that would take a lot longer if you didn't. Right. And so I think it's kind of a play out of the COVID playbook to kind of ratchet up the rhetoric, start to claim that this is now all consuming and we're on the verge. We've already hit 1.5, right? These thresholds that they make, like they had 6 feet apart, which we all learned was just kind of made up. Right. So the 1.5 is kind of made up too, right? It's a convenient threshold so that when we cross it, they can say, look, we need to do more. We need more money. We need to tax you more and control you more. And you know, it, so I think they're taking a page out of the COVID playbook and kind of ratcheting up the rhetoric, because it's a way that they can push their policies through. I mean, it all comes back to money.
It absolutely does. And we're observing that now in the ruminant emissions profiling of this country, and as I call them, the reef fish investors that are now coming around the fringes saying, oh, the New Zealand science machine has done this, but we need to grab that and monetize it over here. And we see some big names all of a sudden starting to want to buy into these biotech companies with the whole ambition of spreading the new technologies to the world. It's going to make such a difference. You know, reduce methane. It's going to make such a difference in a real and mixed atmosphere. I think we've been sold a pup.
Absolutely. And people don't even realize that methane is measured in parts per billion, right? PPB. So, I mean, but, you know, it's another tool, right? It's another way to control and regulate things. It's very convenient, right? Because climate's everything. So it's agriculture. It's what you eat, where you drive, you know, where you work. 15-minute cities. It can permeate into everything. It's such a convenient tool if you want to have more regulation and more control over the public, you know?
And people talking about the fact that systems are complex, and that's, you know, what you enjoy. But again, that whole 1.5 degrees Celsius of warming. And how do we, to me, I'm a layperson, but the fact that we can have a global mean temperature doesn't make sense. We've got tropical rainforests, we've got cold deserts, warm. I mean, it is, how can we reduce this? Isn't it like comparing apples with oranges? How can you have a single global temperature metric?
Yes, you don't. It has absolutely no physical meaning or any scientific meaning, right? I compare it to like the average phone number in the phone book. It's something you could calculate. You could get the average phone number in the phone book. It's probably not going to be a number you can call and or get anything out of. But it's the public needs a single number, right? They just want to see a single metric. So they take this entire system. There's elevation changes. Nobody lives at the global average temperature, right? What is the global average temperature? But they need to reduce the whole system down into one little graph, right? And then make the left hand blue and the right hand really hot red, right? And you can convince people that the planet is heating like crazy. But if you just go outside, you look at city to city and region to region, you don't really see this. Much of this warming that they're talking about is actually happening in the Arctic. Not a lot of people live there. A lot of the warming that we see is actually at night because we've built a lot of infrastructure. So what we're seeing is that our nights don't get as cool as before. And that makes sense. It's an urban heat island effect. But again, it's absolutely physically meaningless in any sort of scientific sense. But it's a convenient metric and a convenient graph to talk about a single number and throw out thresholds like 1.5. And look, we're at 1.6, so we need to do more. But it scientifically has absolutely zero meaning.
And it just on top of all that, in New Zealand, and I'm sure it's happening around the coastal management of the United States as well, we have all our councils and governments are endorsing the use of what is called RCP 8.5, which is the implausible scenario that even the IPCC put up to do our coastal management. And we've got I'm a ratepayer, as a property owner, we pay our property taxes. We've got people wasting a lot of energy on this and putting the fear of the future of anyone having property in the coastal strips. What's your thoughts on that, Dr. Wailiki?
Yeah, so RCP 8.5, which we they're calling it SSP now, 5 to 8.5, it was an end member model. It's essentially a just like test it if everything went to extremes, completely out of the realm of reality. But let's make sure that we have kind of an end member model. When you do models, you kind of want to have end members to kind of know your parameter space. Mm. And that's kind of how you do modeling. And the idea that they take the most extreme end member model to start to base policy off is just absurd. Nobody would do that. There's no, in any sort of statistical analysis, you would never take the outlier model, the very end member, and try to make that as your planning variable. That would be ridiculous, right? You'd be planning for things that aren't very likely going to happen. That most people would consider that a waste, right? We tend to try to plan for the most likely scenarios. And so, you know, the new estimates are something like we'll top out around 2 maybe, you know, in this weird global metric that really has no meaning. But the idea that governments are using end member models is just a way for them to siphon away more money, because clearly the end member model has a lot more disaster and a lot more stuff happening. And so we need much more money so that we can protect, even though this is completely out of the realm of possibility.
Oh, and worse, so they're actually wrecking the ability for people that have got infrastructure or houses in those zones to borrow money, raise a mortgage, get insurance, and yet they're still collecting the local taxes off them at the moment. I mean, I don't know. It's like the pot calling the kettle black. It doesn't seem right, the way we're treating our ratepayers in New Zealand. And are you aware that it's happening on coastal management in, for instance, on the Hamptons near New York? Do you think it'll be happening there?
So, you know, I'm seeing more and more about insurers pulling out of certain places. But the Financial Times just made a report just the other day, and what they claimed was that climate change is actually is a minor factor in insurance cost raises. It's much more has to do with inflation and building supplies and new regulations that have been put in place that are costing these insurance companies so much more money to replace the same infrastructure. And so they kind of let it slip that climate change is really a minor factor. So I really kind of harped on that. But obviously for insurers, again, what a great tool to jack up rates, right? NOAA's saying that the climate's getting worse and disasters are going to be coming every other day. So we're going to have to jack up your rates, right? Yeah. So it's just everybody is in on the game, right? And everybody wants a little taste of the money. And like what Jaspreet was saying before, I think was really important, how it's like little incremental ticks, right? It's not some big giant change. It's these little steps that we're taking. And it's almost like you don't notice it, right? It's you're the frog in the water as it's slowly warming up. We're just taking these little incremental steps. And I just think my radar maybe is a little more sensitive. And I'm like, the road, these steps are leading us to an endpoint. And I think that endpoint isn't where I want to be.
Well, yeah. I'd agree. It's not where I want to be either, in a political sense. And just for listeners, we are talking to Dr. Matthew Wielecki today, and he writes under Irrational Fear at Substack.com. And that's a look, it's just a long list of good output from you, Doctor, about what I would call sustainability realism. Yeah, we use the word sustainability with abandon in the mainstream media. No one really knows what it means, but you've actually put a lot of simple, simply understood output about and the realism that's required to understand why this environmentalism narrative is a bit outlandish. Now, just talking again on the signals for catastrophic events. Everyone uses the word unprecedented or catastrophic. And we've read Roger Pielke Jr.'s output, and we see that the signal for every event in the last century is not anything like catastrophic or unprecedented. In fact, if anything, it's muted now, apart from the temperature signal. Would you like to make comment on that a little further, if you can?
Yeah, so this is what it all comes back to, right? So nobody really cared that the planet was going to warm up a little bit. That wasn't really going to be a problem. In fact, that could extend growing seasons. There's a lot of benefits to a little bit of warming. The problem was, right, that all of these feedbacks that were attached to the warming, right? The warming was going to make billions of people migrate. It was going to cause the food system to collapse. It was going to cause all of these weather events to become more frequent and more intense. So it was all these things attached to the warming, right? And so the signal of warming wasn't really the problem. Everybody kind of agrees that, okay, we kind of make sense that the certain areas are warming. It makes sense with urban heat island. We definitely make sense of urban centers. And we have dramatically changed, and you know, the landscape, and there's land modification is real. And that does change how the solar radiation is interacting with the Earth's surface. Now I lost my train of thought. Where were we going?
Well,
just the whole fact that do we even have signals? Because, you know, Roger Pielke's output,
right,
that IPCC itself and its own documentation says it doesn't have a signal for human-induced changes in these weather patterns. And yet we say unprecedented.
Yeah, and I like to use three metrics, right? I like to use extreme weather. And that comes from the emergency database. So there's a Center for Research in the Epidemiology of Disasters that's in Europe. They track these things. They've been tracking them ever since the 70s. So I look at that number. We don't see an increase since the year 2000. So the database says, look, before the year 2000, our database suffers from underreporting. We weren't a fully interconnected society. So there's a severe bias in the pre-2000 data. So you do see some growth up to about the year 2000, but that's explained by the emergency database system themselves as a bias. If you look post the year 2000, we see no increase in meteorological, hydrological, or climatological disasters. We see a dramatic decrease in loss of life in the last century from weather-related disasters. And as Roger points out in his Substack, The Honest Broker, that we don't see an increase in the costs, right? The overall cost has gone up. This is NOAA loves these billion-dollar disaster claim. Well, of course, a hurricane that hit Miami in 1980 isn't going to do as much damage as a hurricane that hits Miami today. Not because the hurricane's stronger, but because there's something like 700% increase in real estate value in the Miami area just in the last couple of decades, right? And so if you normalize that number like Roger does to percent GDP, you see that there's been no increase in the amount of money that we're spending from these disasters. So there's no loss of life. There's no increase in the intensity or frequency of the disasters, and there's no increase in the costs of these disasters. So the signal only exists in this made-up global warming threshold, right? This global mean temperature. If you look at anywhere else where it would actually be impacting our lives, you don't see it. In fact, what we see is that the CO2 fertilization has increased crop yields like we've never seen. We've actually uncoupled the amount of land that we use with the amount of food that we produce for the first time ever in our society. So we're growing more food and using less land. That's partly because of CO2 fertilization. That's because there's more CO2 in the atmosphere. So all of the negative things, all of the feedbacks that were supposed to be attached to the surface warming signal that I think everybody admits happens, they're just not happening. Right. And those were the impacts that were going to have the dramatic impacts on our lives. Right. The fact that it's a little bit warmer, you're not going to notice. Right. The temperature changes by over a degree and a half in the first hour that the sun comes up. Right. So that's not a big difference. It was all of this stuff that was attached to it. And if you start to look at those numbers, they're just not there.
No, they're just not there. And there's this website I have referred to often during this COVID era called Our World in Data. And they have spoken about this under the disaster database limitations, the EMDAT that you refer to. But it's all in the fine print, isn't it? It's written in the limitations section that time biases result from unequal reporting quality and coverage over time. Technologies and initiatives can be considered responsible for the dominant trend observed. It's as plain as simple as I can, but you know that the small print is missed. You mentioned NOAA, and we have an equivalent here called NEWA. And it's been around for, I believe, nearly three decades now. Their annual spend is to the tune of $180 million a year, which is not small change for a country of just 5 million. And they missed some of the biggest disasters just in the last 150 years, some of the biggest storms. And they advise councils. They advise the government. They are supposed to somehow translate the output from IPCC, which is taken as utter gospel in New Zealand. Completely. No one dare question the IPCC. They are beyond reproach. The United Nations is fabulous. And we have tied ourselves into such knots that it's literally we are going backwards as a country. Economically, I have never, it's just like suicide here. And for a country that's so small, it is massive.
I think people need to realize that the IPCC is a governmental panel, right? It's the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. It's bureaucrats. It's ran by economists primarily that are pushing policy. And they omit the science that doesn't fit the narrative, or they kick the people out that push back against them. And so they manufacture this consensus, this idea that we all agree. Well, sure, if you just kick everybody out that doesn't agree, that's very easy to come up with a consensus, right? And it's taken, like you said, as gospel, but it's all designed, right, to push a certain narrative. So any data that doesn't fit is either in the fine print, somewhere hidden on page 1,000, like 200 and something, right? Or it's just completely ignored. And so it becomes essentially a political document, right? It's not a scientific document.
Yeah, and then you get the summary for policymakers who basically take whatever they want out of that and can manipulate and massage it to create these outcomes that are costing us all dearly.
And there's a significant difference if you read the working assessments and you read what is written to the policymakers. And that's when the social scientists really get involved, because the language really gets ratcheted up to the policymakers, right? You can't say, we're not totally sure, the signal's kind of lost in the noise. You say, nope, the signal is clear as day, and here it is, and it's right around the corner, and we have to act today.
Mm. Well, look, we've had a fair chunk of your time, Dr. Wailiki, and I look at your Substack heading, and it says, it is the function of speech to free men from the bondage of irrational fears. And your Substack is called Irrational Fear at Substack.com. We can only thank you for writing these Substacks and your prolific output. We're so grateful we could have you on RCR Greenwashed. We hope to have you back. We haven't even talked about your earth sciences passion around zircons. I sort of read that and my eyes glazed over, but maybe we'll get you to talk about that another day. Great to have you on our show. I know we could have gone on for hours, but we're so... So in your debt for having you give your time so willingly for us. Thank you.
Well, thank you for having me. I'd love to come back sometime.
Thank you so much. It's been brilliant. And I'm sure our audience is going to have some great feedback on this one. Dr. Matthew, have a great rest of the day.
Thank you.
The RCR shop has great gift ideas, from great looking tees, hoodies, caps, tote bags, bumper stickers and more. The RCR shop is now open at www.realitycheck.radio/shop.